All right, thanks everyone. I want to introduce our first speaker is Dan Pallone from Element 84. And he'll be talking about building FilmDrop, an open source software platform for Earth observation. So let's welcome Dan.
Hello everybody, thank you for coming. I'm Dan Pallone, I'm CEO of Element 84, and I'm going to talk about our experiences with building FilmDrop, and in more general terms, our experiences building a business on top of open source. So I've tried to structure this around key principles, key takeaways that we've learned from our open source work. You can realistically consider these scars. I tried to frame them in a positive sense, but realistically what we're talking about are things that we got wrong or had to sort out. And in retrospect, okay, that was the right decision, but forward looking is always way harder. I want to emphasize this is our experience. This, you might talk to somebody else and get a completely different take on all of this, so kind of buyer beware. Before I get started, I want to talk about what we mean by business of open source. So really it comes down to what are you trying to achieve with your business? Are you trying to find a way to keep a paycheck coming so that you can continue to work on the open source that you want to work on? Or alternatively, are you trying to build a bigger business and open source is a piece of that strategy? There isn't a right or a wrong answer, but they're not the same. And we actually switched to some extent from the find a way to keep working on what we want to work on to, okay, we need to grow a business. This is kind of the pointy-haired talk or pointy-haired boss talk of open source, so bear with me. All right, so for E84, we are a services business. We've been around for about 14 years. We're coming up on 14 years now. We have about $15 million in annual revenue. We recently acquired Azavia out of Philadelphia. And we originally started with the idea of we just want to be a small company. We weren't going to be bigger than five people. We were going to be five people working on the work that we wanted to work on, work that mattered, with people we liked working with. We had no real intentions of getting much beyond that. What we learned quickly, though, was that if we didn't change our thinking around what we were doing with the company, we were going to have people career out of the company. People were progressing in their careers. They wanted to run a project. They wanted to work on bigger things. They wanted to try different things. They wanted to get plugged into different pieces. And we had to either let the company grow or accept that we were going to have people that helped get us there, the people who we wanted to work with, we were going to have them career out. It meant we had to shift our mindset to say, okay, we need to grow a business first, and open source was part of that strategy, but it wasn't the other way around. So, all right, let me start with where we are today. So, protagonist of the story is FilmDrop. I'm going to use this as kind of the context for everything I'm going to talk about, but it's not really a FilmDrop talk. FilmDrop's our open source geospatial data lake solution. It is in production. It's supporting multiple commercial satellite operators. It supports the United Nations. We have petabytes of data we're maintaining in AWS Open Data Program coming out. They're all being maintained by FilmDrop. It supports the features you would expect: ingest, archive, distribution, processing, discovery, cloud native workflows, stack-based APIs, metadata, stack-based metadata, dashboards, visualizations, all the things you would expect in a cloud-native geospatial data lake software. It's 100% open source, except for the pieces that are customer specific. It's built on top of all your favorite Phosphor-G solutions, T-Tiler, Stack Server, StackFast API, kind of all of those pieces build this up, plus custom solutions, pieces that we've deployed. I'm sorry, we've open sourced. But we didn't start there. We didn't get started at this point, obviously. It was a long road to get there, and that's kind of where all these lessons learned come from. Scrolling it back, we've supported NASA's Earth Science Division for over a decade. In the course of that work, we've built parts of their Earth Science Archive solution. We've helped transition, it's going to be 40 petabytes of Earth Science data into from the DAX on-prem to the cloud. The whole thing is built to scale up to 200 plus petabytes once you start adding SWAT and ISAR missions. NASA has a strong commitment to open source and has made a lot of tooling available. I have CMR and Cumulus on the screen here, but there's lots of different tooling. So put ourselves there, right? We have lots of experience in remote sensing data, big remote sensing data, petabytes. We've built tooling on top of it. We understand cloud native geospatial capabilities. And at the same time, the commercial space market's starting to ramp up. We saw an opportunity to expand beyond the federal work we were doing and into commercial work and bring some of these solutions over. We literally launched our first commercial offering at a European Space Agency Living Planet Symposium in Italy. We stood up CubesatData.com. There was clearly a need for some kind of commercial self-hosted ingest archive processing solution. We thought we could apply the NASA pieces to do this and bring this out to the commercial market. When we first put this up, we were targeting universities and small sat operators. There's a whole other talk I gave at ESIP a while ago about the CubeSat, SmallSat space. You can get a ride to low Earth orbit for about $300,000. You could build a CubeSat for even cheaper than that. There are CubeSat.com kind of spaces, sites where you can just go and order parts and assemble these and set this whole thing up. So we thought, our hypothesis was that a university could literally take a graduate class and design, build, launch, and operate a CubeSat. Tie in other disciplines, be able to take advantage of that data that was being collected, and kind of build this whole experience out for their graduate and postgraduate students. The whole thing would burn back in about 6 months, but that seemed totally reasonable amount of time to do this. And what we thought was, okay, they don't want to have to build and maintain the infrastructure to be able to do this. So we got to the point, we were thinking this through to the point of like, you could enter a credit card number, hit a button, spin up a geospatial data lake solution, use it for the 6 months that thing was on orbit, and then spin it back down when you were done. It didn't play out that way at all. The launch of CubeSatData.com, we went talking about it, the whole deal. It did get us our first customer, our first commercial customer, but they were a full VC-backed startup who has since gone on to be a major player in this whole space. We started building out their infrastructure, but their needs were different. And it didn't take us long for us to realize that what we were doing, the software, the open source we were using just wasn't going to be a good fit. It was great for NASA, it just didn't transfer over as smoothly as we'd expected. So I'm gonna take this and go into the kind of the first point. And some of these are gonna sound obvious, but really we had to put all these things together to get to today. So build what your customers need, not what you want. What we had was close. On the surface, it would do what we needed it to do, but at a detail level, it just wasn't the right tooling for the job. It wasn't the right solution for that job. It had too many NASA-specific bits about it. It was great, but it was wrong for what we needed. I'm bringing this up here because open source is often talked about in the context of developers scratching their own itch. When we talk about the business of open source, that's fine if developers are your customers. If they're not, you have to identify your customer's itch and scratch those. So that led us to our next challenge. Okay, what happens if our customers are actually different than NASA's? Or we were starting to realize that our customers were actually different than basically the code base, the problem it was intended to solve, the customers it was intended to solve for, our customers were different. They had different needs. So now what? Do we fork that code base? Do we commit these changes upstream that might not align with the original goals? There's room for like a whole talk here around kind of the software model, but this is really the next major piece, is being aware of, if you're in control of the code, you can divine the sharing model. If you're not in control of the code, you need to understand the sharing model that you're engaging in. NASA is a major open source contributor. It's awesome. They do amazing pieces. We're part of it on the NASA side. But the model is largely, here's the tooling we're building, we'll make it available, and hopefully somebody else can make it useful. Contributing changes back to the NASA code base that really aren't much use to NASA means at best a higher maintenance cost for them, where they're maintaining a bunch of code that they really don't care about, or at worst, it kicks off a tug of war on this project between where NASA needs it to go and where we needed it to go. And I'm saying NASA here, but substitute, pick your group in here, however you want. So we reached a point where we had to make a call. We had done some work before under a separate NASA Access grant around point cloud data. We had built an open source, something closer to what we needed. This is what eventually became Cirrus. Our choices at that point were, do we invest in the code base we had started to mature it and get it ready for full production, or do we fork and adapt the NASA code base? Stepping back and looking at the big picture architecture, we had a couple goals we wanted to achieve. One, we needed to fully embrace community standards, and two, we wanted to write and maintain as little custom code as we could get away with. There were existing projects that could be significant architectural components that we could just pick up and use. And then we had the foundations of the pieces that we were missing that we could build up from that earlier grant work. We could start migrating from the NASA code base immediately onto our simpler code base, and ultimately that's what we decided to do. That became the real code base underlying FilmDrop. I want to emphasize, like, this was a non-trivial decision. There were fantastic components available in open source, but we were going to need to adopt some of those to make sure they kept moving forward at the pace we needed them to in order for this to be a viable commercial offering. We were then going to have to build the missing pieces that we needed, and really the most important piece was we had to figure out a way to pay for all of this. At the end of the day, we invested about $1.5 million in building out FilmDrop, the initial kind of, it's grown since then, but the pieces I'm talking about here, we had invested that to get to the production level state of what we were able to then take out, and we needed a way to recoup that money. So, these are going to get progressively more antagonistic as we go. So this was our next lesson learned here. Open source development without a business plan is not an investment. It is a donation. It is existentially important to understand that distinction. It is way too easy to focus on all of the other real benefits of open source that you gloss over the question of how am I going to pay for this work? So this is the point where I expect the audience to like turn on the presenter. If everybody wants to look back and like this is when it goes sideways, it's going to go south from here. So I am a card-carrying open source proponent, but if I put my business of open source hat on, I have to encourage you to force yourself to answer the question of what is the business justification for me to open source this work? Answers like it's good for the community or this way other people will maintain it for us are siren sounds for well-intentioned businesses. If that's all you have are those answers and your business depends on the success of what you're open sourcing, there's a really good chance you're gonna end up smashing on the rocks. Now, if what you're doing, you're considering as a donation, awesome. This whole discussion doesn't apply. But if you're considering an investment upon which you expect a return, answers like someone else will maintain it for me is distracting at best and catastrophic at worst. So taking it back to FilmDrop, when we talked about FilmDrop, we got to two very pragmatic answers to that question. For existing components, us forking that code base and keeping the fork private provided no value. This was a case where we wanted to mature and build on existing code bases. We could enhance existing projects. And the more people using that code, the more widely compatible everything we were building was, regardless of whether we deployed it or somebody else deployed it. Ultimately, this was a rising tides kind of a scenario. For new code we were about to write, we had a different discussion. In that case, what we were talking about was we were approaching satellite startups and asking them to build their business on top of our solution. They're building out petabyte scale archives. Us open sourcing FilmDrop, like all the pieces that we were adding to it, tying all this stuff together, was a business risk mitigation strategy for them. We weren't asking them to rely on a proprietary code base. We weren't asking them to be forever beholden to Element 84 for their core platform. They could move the effort in-house as their business grew. If ultimately they faced the same point where FilmDrop was going was not where they wanted to go, they could have those same kinds of discussions. We had clear value propositions for both pieces of this. Why should we open source FilmDrop? We had solid answers to those questions. So we then open sourced it. So this is where it gets a little thorny. When at a high level, well, I guess, okay, so understand how IP works and define the rules you need. All right, so at a high level, what most customers want is that every line of code you write, they own. There are some wonderful customers out there, some in the audience, who understand and believe in the open source ecosystem, but that's not a universal truth. This is especially tricky if you get into the venture or PE-backed startup world. That code base, the code base that they're building their solutions on, is often considered part of business operations and is frequently included in kind of a business valuation calculation. And so there's a discussion to be had there if they can't count it as part of their overall value, their internal IP, et cetera, then that's a thing all the way up to the VC firm or the funds that are backing it. Now, for developers, they frequently want to build and contribute back to open source code bases. This is especially the case in geospatial and the open standards community. I'm not pointing at anybody, but this is like a big thing. So for a geospatial software company like Element 84, we're sitting in the middle of all of this. We want to look at the intellectual property that we own. We want to look at the intellectual property that we contribute to. We want to look at all of this as a whole, so that we can reuse where we can to consistently drive revenue from said customers to pay said developers. If you're building a business, you need to navigate all kinds of customers. It's really difficult to just say, I'm only going to work with customers who get open source, or I'm only going to, why don't we only take contracts that where the customer's cool with us, just, you know, it's built into the contract. It's a conversation that we had to learn to get good at and to be able to negotiate at a legal level with attorneys. So this mindset and the business risk to us had to be incorporated into our contracts and then ultimately had to be negotiated with our clients. A lot of default contracts that you'll get are what are called works for hire. I'm sure a lot of you know this, but in case you don't, this is really important to know. They're considered works for hire. That means at the end, the client owns everything you write. First of all, that's a non-starter for us for open source, period. We can't transfer over the licenses for open source code that we don't own, right? It's open source, we can use it, we abide by the license that it's released with, but we can't transfer the title to that. Furthermore, if we talk about FilmDrop specifically, it means after our first customer, we would no longer own FilmDrop. Now, all that said, when we are working with customers, what we're doing is tailoring FilmDrop, right? We're building specific workflows. We're building custom pieces to work with their specific solutions. And we have deep insight into their instruments. We know what their capabilities are. We know what data products they're producing. We know what services they're offering. We can't open source everything. There is a lot of legitimately proprietary information that we have to deal with. So the solution to this was basically both contractual and technical. We had to have clear legal provisions in the contracts to protect both us and the customer. And then we needed a technical architecture that allows us to cleanly separate the open source pieces and the pieces that we needed to keep private to protect customer proprietary information. So we have clauses in our contract around what licenses are permitted. How do we automate scanning for them? How do we handle export control? How do we handle requesting permission to open source something that isn't proprietary but was built under the contract? What kind of indemnification do we offer for our customers when we're using open source code? All of this gets baked into the contract. Again, if what you're doing is informal and smaller, that's one thing. But if you're doing, but this is the business of open source track. Taking these things seriously from the start is critical because you're potentially getting involved with 100 plus million dollar organizations. You've got VC funds, you've got PE firms, you've got publicly traded companies with fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. You need to understand the space that you're operating in and the contracts need to reflect it. Okay. All right. So we get through that. We stand up FilmDrop, right? Our initial offering of FilmDrop. FilmDrop starts out with FilmDrop Core, which is the ingest archive processing data lake piece of it. On top of that, we have FilmDrop DR, which is a field deployable version of FilmDrop. We can push that out on a snow cone or a snowball. So drone data, things along those lines, aerial data, in situ data. FilmDrop UI provides visualization capabilities on top of the whole thing. And FilmDrop Analytics provides, you know, your usual notebook interface. How do you operate on top of FilmDrop? How do you interact with the data lake sitting underneath of it? We launch EarthSearch. Earth Search is a publicly available endpoint, stack compliant endpoint that we stand up on top of AWS public data set. There's about 17 petabytes of data sitting behind it. We field about up to 14 million queries a day against this. We have customers building out solutions on top of FilmDrop, right? We're in production now. We have people, we have operational customers using this. We launched the Earth Search console, which is kind of a visual capability to look through the AWS public data set holdings, Sentinel, NAEP, Landsat, et cetera. We push all of these things out. And I want to stop here for a second because this is an important point in the FilmDrop lifecycle. FilmDrop brought in revenue every day from day one until today. It wasn't always profitable, but it was always in a position of being validated by the market by bringing in money. When we iterated on business plans, to improve FilmDrop profitability, not to determine if there was a market for it. We had already proven that there was a market out there. Clay Christensen, who's attributed with the idea of disruptive innovation, is quoted as saying, "Be patient for growth and impatient for profit." I'm going to throw out there that the business of open source version of this is something like this. Be patient for pull requests, impatient for paying customers. So moving forward, okay, so now we get to today. We're kind of at real time now. All right, remember, Element 84 is a services company. The business road is littered with carcasses of services companies who started out with strong service offerings and then at some point get the bug of, if we just turn this into a product, people will pay us money for the software and we won't have to charge hourly anymore. Like, this is like, there's lots of flavors of this. We can charge for the same software multiple times. We'll be in charge of where it goes. We don't have to work with the customer on this. We can put a dedicated team on it. Okay, this is said so many times that this is like a cliche, right? A product company is fundamentally different than a services company. I think one of the particular challenges with open source is it makes it super easy to confuse the two. And don't do that. They have different revenue models. They rely on business functions differently. They have different sales cycles. They are not the same business. Trying to do both at the same time is inevitably going to starve one of them, especially for a small business. People are going to point out things like, you know, but Esri has a services team. If you're a billion-dollar company, you can do a whole lot of things that you can't get away with when you're a million-dollar or tens of million-dollar company. Which takes us to kind of the next lesson learned here. Is deciding whether you're leading with product, services, or services, and organize accordingly. I'm going to give you two examples. So I'm not saying one is right or wrong. I'm just going to kind of point out two different ones. First one's Crunchy Data. All right, Crunchy Data's homepage, and it's about Postgres, no question. Yesterday in the B2B, Eddie Pickle mentioned, if you want to talk Postgres, come see me. I'm going to compare that to a company called KiteString. KiteString also uses open source, but they see themselves as offering services. They don't lead with a software product, they lead with consulting services. Again, I'm not saying one is right or wrong, but which one you are and how you think about yourself then has ramifications across the company. We went down a whole rabbit hole around FilmDrop. How do we charge for FilmDrop? How do we charge for Earth Search? Do we offer an Earth Search Pro? What kind of pricing do we put on our website? Can we make it single button deployment? While we were thrashing around with this, I had a chance to meet the author of a book called The Experience Economy, Jim Gilmore. It's an older book, but it makes an argument about the shift in the economy to experiences. There's a whole conversation we can have about whether B2B, B2C experiences are the same, et cetera, but it got us thinking about what are we doing. We had open source FilmDrop, we had built on top of open source components. Everyone had access to all of these things. We were at constant risk of commoditization from cloud providers. Why was FilmDrop still successful despite all of those challenges? What were we really offering? And ultimately what we realized, or what we hypothesized, was that customers were engaging with us for our expertise. FilmDrop was a bootstrap mechanism. It was a risk reduction mechanism. It was a time to market mechanism. We thought customers were coming to us for FilmDrop, but we don't think that any longer. We think our customers are coming to us for our expertise and the ability to accelerate what they're doing and how fast we can help them do it. Film drop and open source is a tool that we can bring to bear. This might not seem like a big difference. You're probably thinking, how did this guy even get a speaking slot with this? But like, this was a huge aha moment for us. And it got us talking about the film drop experience. I'm not allowed to show this slide to customers, but I got the okay because this is a technical conference. I could show the slide internally. The film drop experience means we had to put our customer, or put ourselves in our customer position. What do they really want? We're just a means to an end. So accelerating film drop deployment, so it's a one-click button push, it isn't really what they want. They have a bigger goal. That's what we wanted, but it's not what they really needed. So we need to build what they need and what they want. Shifting like this got us, like, really opened the space that we could think about. And one of the more exciting ones is it let us start talking about Film Drop Edge. We realized there was a use case here. This is on-orbit processing for geospatial data and being able to push it all the way out to either edge. It let us talk about things like, how do we cannibalize our own offerings? How do we think about our pricing models? Who are even our potential customers? And ultimately, to answer the question I threw out earlier, we lead with services. Open source and film drop in particular are tools in our tool belt to deliver those services. But at the end of the day, we are a services organization. So, recap, build what your customers need, not necessarily what you want. Define or be aware of the sharing model for open source you're using. Open source development is, without a business plan, is not an investment, it's a donation. Understand how IP works. Be patient for pull requests, impatient for paying customers, and decide if you're going to lead with product or services and organize accordingly. Thank you for the time. I think I'm okay. I'm done. Are you okay? All right. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer any questions whenever time permits, or if somebody fundamentally disagrees with everything I said, please tell me. I'd love to get this right faster next time. Yeah. Thank you.